finish up from last time, the exceptions to the decree against, the gzeira against use of medicine for mild cases on Shabbos, then to have a quiz on the exceptions, and then to move on to the issue of pikuach nefesh, of actually saving lives on Shabbos. How do we know it, and what are some of the rules pertaining to the treatment that we can give in a pikuach nefesh case? Right? Everyone's on the same page. Everyone knows. Everyone has the source sheet. I remember to upload it this time. It's the last one that I uploaded, so it should say number five, because this is class number five.
Thank you.
I have a very scientific method of labeling the sheets. So last time round, we said that the first exception is the case in which there is no grinding involved for that kind of treatment. No one would ever need to grind ingredients for it. And therefore, we say that you're allowed to use medicine. We have zero concern that you're going to end up grinding. Anyone remember an example of an illness that is treated that way? Yeah.
Like if you dislocate your jaw.
Right, a dislocated jaw would be a good example of it. Ariana, that was you were going to say?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the... That was the first one. The second exception was an ongoing treatment, right? A treatment that already started before Shabbos and is simply continuing now, right? We talked about the case of the bandage that fell off, and we also gave the case from the Gemara of Asafotida, the Chiltit, right? We had started on it on Thursday and Friday, and he asked in the Beis Medrash, what do? Does this ring a bell? People looking at me like, what? No, it was? Yeah, Lisa. It should say on the sheet, Shabbos number 5, Saving Lives, Part 1. That's what you're looking for. So yes, and we remember why we said that an ongoing treatment is okay? What was the rationale? Right, it creates real problems in the event that a person is not, is not able to take it. Then yes, the whole thing is going to be undone. So that's no good. That's correct. Jesse, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was our second exception. Our third exception was the case of ma'achal b'riyim, that which is what normal people eat. It's not considered to be medicine for most people. And why did we say that was okay?
No maris ayin.
No maris ayin. No consideration that somebody might see it and misunderstand. And it also is a case where you prepared it before Shabbos, right? We had this discussion. The case in the Gemara was the case of the kilorin, the eyewash, right? Where we said that you prepared it before Shabbos, and people will just assume that you're cleaning out your eyes. They won't realize that it's actually done for medicinal purposes, and therefore it was okay. That was the explanation that we saw from Rashi. We also saw the Rashba's idea that there's no gezeira in the first place. The whole decree didn't apply to things that people normally eat, where looking at it, you couldn't tell the difference, right? We gave the example, the potential example of aspirin, right? The quote from Rabbi Jachter. So the last of our exceptions, we saw this last time at the very end very quickly, is the case of something that was mixed into food before Shabbos. And we said, again, very similar to what we said regarding ma'achal b'riyim according to Rashi, right? It was that it was prepared before Shabbos then, and because it's mixed into food, no one is going to think that you're using medicine. It's the same idea. But if you take a look in the Shulchan Aruch, in source number 1, you see it brought there, where he's talking about, indeed, the eye. The one that says at the top, number 5, Saving Lives, Part 1? Right? That should say that. Okay. So the Shulchan Aruch gives us the eyewash case. He says, one may soak kilurin before Shabbos and place it on the eye on Shabbos. It only appears like washing, so long as it doesn't squeeze the eye closed and open it, like showing that it's medicinal. And we're not concerned about grinding ingredients, since they only permitted him to soak them before Shabbos. There is a reminder that functions as a reminder. So that's actually not... I really should have used a different source, because that's not so clear. Like, that looks exactly the same as the case in which people can't tell the difference because it's... the case of ma'achal b'riyim, the healthy food case. But, that's not the best example. But the idea is still, where it's mixed into food before Shabbos, you would be okay. Yeah?
I'm just confused on the Rosh Hashanah explanation of why it's never prohibited.
Yeah. So the Rashba says they didn't make the Gezeira for cases in which an onlooker can't tell the difference because it looks like what people normally do. If you were to say to somebody, wait, that's not allowed, you're not allowed to take medicine on Shabbos, they would just say, well, I'm not doing it for that purpose. I'm doing it because I like drinking olive oil. Right? That was the case he was talking about, was the olive oil case. It wasn't clear to me what he meant. In other words, did he mean because we can't apply it? You know, or did he just mean it's, you know, food is allowed, therefore food is allowed even when you have it for medicinal purposes? That's the other way you could read the Rashba, right? Everyone follows that. The why of it is a little bit unclear. That is the Rashba statement that the Gezeira doesn't apply.
It looks the same as to something someone
yeah. Right. I mean, if I knew someone was sick, I might question it.
Right.
And they'll just say, no, I just like drinking olive oil. It's a thing. Yeah. For some reason. Yes, Ella.
Is the Shulchan Aruch saying, like, the two reasons again, Marzayim and Marzayim?
Yes. Yeah. That's why I really shouldn't have brought that piece from the Shulchan Aruch, because it's very confusing. It's the same thing as what we saw in number three. I shouldn't confuse matters. Okay. So that brings us to the end of the exceptions. I'm going to hand out the quiz. It's the same type of picking up. We're now up to really what I consider to be the second part. Like, meaning everything we did until now was just basic background about Shabbos, about medicine, about the conflict of someone who's ill on Shabbos, and our duty to Shabbos as well as our duty to take care of their health. And this rabbinic decree against medicine for mild cases on Shabbos, right? That basically is what we've done, you know, the last four classes. So what we're going to do now is get a better understanding of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives on Shabbos, starting with how do we know that pikuach nefesh overrides Shabbos? When you have these two major issues going head to head, how do you know which one wins? That's number one. Number two, not necessarily in this order, we'll see, but whether a person is allowed to decline. What if they say, I know that halacha says that you should override Shabbos to save my life, but I don't want you to. I'd rather keep Shabbos. So now what do you do? How far do we go in taking care of somebody on Shabbos? What, is it only that which is necessary to save their lives, or other treatments as well that are just part of maintaining their health? One of the questions that was asked, I think the first week, does this apply, the idea of overriding Shabbos to save lives, does it apply to all lives? Does it apply to someone who is not Jewish and therefore will never keep Shabbos? Is that, you know, included here? All of this will be part of our conversation over the next few classes. Okay, clear? Good? Okay, so we start with how we know that Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbos. And that's source number two on your sheet. It's a classic Gemara in Yuma. Yuma or Yoma, it's the same thing. It's a Masechta, which for the most part deals with Yom Kippur issues, along with certain other issues. The reason why the discussion is in Yuma, as opposed to Masechta Shabbos, is because the Gemara talks about a case where a building collapses on Yom Kippur, and now you need to get people out. And, well, let me start from the real beginning. The real beginning is a discussion of fasting on Yom Kippur and people who are not capable of fasting and overriding Yom Kippur to save lives. That's really where we go, you know, where, that's our jumping off point for this discussion about saving lives at the expense of Yom Kippur or Shabbos. That's really the starting point. So the Gemara says, it describes the sages sitting together, and I skipped the introductory piece of it in the Gemara to get to the direct point. So Nishala She'ela Zu Bifnehem. This question was asked before the sages. How do we know, Minayin, how do we know that Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbos? The starting point is we know that it does. Right? You notice that in the Gemara? There's no one who's debating that it does. The question is just, how do you know that this is true? What's our source for it? So we're going to get a series of approaches. And I underlined sort of the key lines in each one in the Hebrew just to help people. So the first one to answer is Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Yishmael quotes you a pasuk which is found in Parshas Mishpatim. It's talking about a case in which somebody breaks into a person's house. You are the homeowner, not you. It shouldn't happen to you. Somebody is a homeowner. In the middle of the night, they hear somebody tunneling into the house, breaking down a door, whatever it is. They have the means of killing the invader. They have a gun, whatever it is. They have the means of killing the invader. Are they allowed to kill the invader on Shabbos? This isn't about Shabbos. Are they allowed to kill the invader in the middle of the night? That's the question. And the Torah says that in b'machteres yimatzei haganav, if a thief is found in this tunnel entering the house, the rule is v'hukava mace, and he is struck and he is killed. Ein lo damim, he has no blood. And what that means is you owe nothing. You don't have to pay anything. You have no guilt as the homeowner, because maybe he was really coming in with the intention to kill the people who live there. You don't know. Yeah.
Is it only if he kills him in the tunnel?
Yes. Only if you catch him. Not a tunnel per se, like, but only if you catch him in the act of breaking in.
Okay.
If he's
in the house, you can't.
No, that's as part of the break-in. In other words, guy breaks into the house, takes whatever he's taking, and is leaving, and at that point, you catch up to him, he's already out of the house, you're not justified anymore.
What if he's just in the house and roaming around?
Then you are justified. The key is the uncertainty of, this person might be willing to kill me, to take my life, therefore I am justified in taking his life in self-defense. That's the idea. So on that, Rabbi Yishmael says, look, this person, the invader, may have come just for property and not to kill anybody. In the event that he were caught, he would just run away. But he also may have come to kill. He may have come for life and death. Bloodshed, for you to kill somebody inappropriately, contaminates the land, metameyes haaretz in the Hebrew, causes the Shekhinah to leave us. Bloodshed is terrible. Killing somebody inappropriately is awful. And yet, one may save him, the homeowner, we assume, with his life. There are different ways to translate that line. I'm taking the simplest way. We say that the homeowner is allowed to save himself by killing the invader, even though killing someone is such a terrible thing. It contaminates the land. It causes Hashem to leave. We never want to kill somebody. Nonetheless, we say that you're justified in doing so. How much more so does saving lives override Shabbos? In other words, if to save yourself, you are allowed to kill somebody else, you are certainly allowed to override Shabbos in order to save yourself or to save somebody. To put it a little bit differently, what this is really, oh, I forgot I have markers. What this really is a kal v'chomer, right? Everyone knows, you're familiar with the term kal v'chomer, right? Classic example of a kal v'chomer, you have two people, A and B. A is stronger than B. If B is able to lift 50 pounds, then of course A is able to lift 50 pounds. I don't know how much A can lift, because I don't know how much stronger A is than B. I don't know if he can lift 50.1 or 70 or who knows. But I know A is stronger than B. A is able to lift at least as much as B is able to lift. So we're talking about the laws of Shabbos, and we're talking about the laws of bloodshed, of killing. And what we're effectively saying here is bloodshed is more severe than Shabbos. That's our starting. Bloodshed causes Hashem to leave us. Bloodshed is horrible. And yet, you're allowed to do it in order to save lives. So, saving lives overrides concern for bloodshed. How much more so is saving lives then overrides Shabbos? That's Rabbi Yishmael's argument. Got it? Yeah, Ariana.
So, if bloodshed doesn't... The cause, not the cause-effect, isn't
breaking
Shabbos. Is
breaking
Shabbos
hard?
No.
Breaking Shabbos is Misa.
Right.
And so is bloodshed.
So it's on the same level, not bloodshed.
What Rabbi Yishmael is saying is that bloodshed is worse than breaking Shabbos. Shedding someone's blood inappropriately is worse than breaking Shabbos. That's what he says. Now, I'm only bringing you one piece of the Gemara, which is the part where we present all of these arguments. What I'm not bringing you is the part where, after that, the sages show the weaknesses of each of the arguments. So don't take the statement that bloodshed is worse than Shabbos as a given, undisputed, and undebated. It's just that we're not going through the debate part of the Gemara. If you want to, I think that's great. But I didn't feel it was relevant for our specific halachic discussion here. So that's Rabbi Yishmael's argument. Bloodshed is worse than Shabbos. Bloodshed is overridden to save lives. Shabbos is overridden to save lives. That's his argument. Second argument, Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Bris Mila, circumcision, is one of 248 Evarim of a man's body, and it overrides Shabbos. The way he's looking at it is, Bris Mila is like saving a part of his body. That's the way that they're looking at it. So if Bris Mila saves part of the body, and it overrides Shabbos, because indeed, if the eighth day is Shabbos, we do Bris Mila, only if it's the eighth day, but we do, then if that overrides Shabbos, Sakal v'chomer, how much more so, l'chol gufo, you're saving his entire body. So certainly that overrides Shabbos. Clear? All we're doing is taking Rabbi Yishmael's Kal v'chomer and substituting, instead of bloodshed, we're putting in Bris Mila. Right? Clear? That's all we did. That's Rabbi Elazar. It's right here on the sheet. The people who are speaking in this debate, by the way, are all Tanaim. They're from the time of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Yehuda gives me a third approach, a little more challenging than a Kal v'chomer. He says, the Torah says, Es Shabso Sai Tishmoru. Okay, you shall guard my Shabbos. This is in Parshas Kisisa. You shall guard my Shabbatot. That's what the Torah says. Yochol Lakol, I might think that means Shabbos overrides everything. Guard my Shabbos is no matter what. Shabbos is primary, everything else is secondary? No, because the opening word in that passage in the Torah is ach. Let me put this on here to make it a little more clear. The part that he quoted first is where Hashem says, guard my Shabbatot. But the opening word in the passage is only. Ah. Now, pshat read of the sentence. Only guard my Shabbatot is saying, I only care about the fact that you guard my Shabbos. Like, just make sure you keep Shabbos. Pshat read in the pasuk, that's what it's saying. But the word ach in Hebrew is a tricky word. Because in the Gemara's perspective, the word ach is an exclusion. When you see the word ach, aleph chaf, in the Torah, it's saying this doesn't apply in 100% of circumstances. And so the argument that is brought by Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, is that ach distinguishes and says that sometimes you don't observe Shabbos, and where is that? Pikuach nefesh, saving lives. It's the word ach, that's the magic word. It says, guard my Shabbatot, but not all the time. There's going to be a case where you don't guard it. Is that clear? It shouldn't be clear. It's a bizarre idea, no? Like, the word ach and a pshat read is saying, I just want you to guard my Shabbos. But on the medrash level, this word wasn't necessary in the pasuk. It must be added to teach me something. It's teaching me, don't always guard my Shabbos. There's a case which you don't. Ella.
I think it doesn't bring any truth
about being fulfilled. Sorry? Doesn't like, right. Correct. No, he just says there must be something, and that's what it is.
And then he uses logic to figure out what it is.
Yeah. Correct. Sorry? We're good? Okay. So that's the third of the arguments. It's the word ach. It's ach es shabso sai tishmoru. If you're looking on the sheet, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda's line,
okay.
That's where you want to be. Okay. Rabbi Yonasan ben Yosef is in the same passage in Parshas Kisisa, where it says you should guard Shabbos, ki kodesh hi lachem, because it is holy for you. And it's very funny, because whereas the previous approach, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, was very technical, you have this magic word, ach, the approach of Rabbi Yonasan ben Yosef is actually more logical as a read. The pasuk says, ki kodesh hi lachem, Shabbos is holy for you. He says, oh, it's holy for you means it's supposed to help you. It's beneficial to you. Shabbos is yours. So he, misura b'yedchem, Shabbos is given into your hands. V'lo atem misurim b'yada, you are not given over into the hands of Shabbos. Meaning, if it's a choice between your needs and Shabbos's needs, we're going to put your needs first. Now, as Ella noted on the previous one, this isn't open-ended. Like, you could then say, oh, so if I want to go on a trip on Shabbos, Shabbos is given into my hands. I am not given into Shabbos. No, that doesn't work. It's only saying that when it comes to the most dire of needs, Shabbos is in your hands, you are not in Shabbos's hands.
Where's the source for that?
For which thing? Oh, it's that pasuk that he just quoted. Ki kodesh hi lachem. Are you following in the Hebrew or the English? Everywhere. So in the Hebrew, you want line number 7. In the English, you want, I don't know, it's 8 or 9 or so. Rabbi Yonasan bar Yosef. For it is holy for you. Yeah. So it is holy for you means it's really yours. Now, all of the... Yeah, Abby.
These are only cases of, like, if your life is in danger. So, in a case where your life isn't in danger, do these not apply? If, even if you're sick?
So, these are all life and death cases, correct. Only life and death. We wanted to know, how do you know life and death override Shabbos? That's all we're getting out of this. Clear? So, all of the arguments that we just brought are very important arguments, but none of them end up being the winning halachic argument. The Gemara goes through them and gives arguments against them. Yes?
It's just a little bit off-putting, because aren't they a little bit concerned that this sentence could be spun into a different direction where people could say, like, oh, if Shabbos is in my hands, then, like, I can do whatever I want. Like, it's very simple to take that in a different direction.
Right. So the answer is yes, it could be taken a different direction. You have to remember what Gemara was meant to be originally. Yeah.
The Gemara was written for the smart people.
Well, not specifically for the smart people.
It was also,
but for
it was also like it was conversation that happened to be written down.
Right. This is true. Not just happened. It was a choice. But more than that, Gemara fundamentally was meant to be for the initiated. This is meant to be for the people who are part of the debate about understanding halacha and evolving halacha. And even though there's lots of Gemara, which is not technically halacha-oriented, it teaches me values which may lead to halacha, or you know, in some way, tangentially, it will connect back to halacha, medicinal sections in the Gemara, things like that. Nonetheless, the basic understanding that Gemara has of itself is, this is for people who are going to take it seriously. This is not meant for people who will take it and, you know, use it for something else. In our era, Gemara has changed. It's become a lot more accessible. You know, 100 years ago, the Daf Yomi program began. There were no translations and recordings of Shiurim. If you wanted to learn Daf Yomi, you were, you know, going to a Shiur. But that's, you know, there's been a fundamental concern down through the ages that if someone is either looking at it with an eye towards, you know, challenging it, or if someone doesn't take it seriously, it absolutely could be mishandled and create problems. This is true. So again, all of the explanations that we brought do not survive halachic analysis in the end. The next two do, and they become very important in this area of halacha and in other areas of halacha. That doesn't mean you should forget everything we did. It was Gemara. It's important to know.
Rabbis that we just did, none of their answers.
Their answers don't win. Yeah. Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh gives you a logical argument based in a pasuk. The Torah says, "Vishamaru v'nei Yisrael es ha-Shabbos." The Jews shall observe Shabbos. Okay, that sounds good. The Torah is saying, "Chalel alav Shabbos achas kedei sheyishmor Shabbosos harbei." Hashem wants you to observe Shabbos. If you need to violate one Shabbos in order to be able to observe many Shabbatot, that's what you do. You follow? If you need to violate one Shabbos to be able to observe many, as in, this person, if they die, that's it for their Shabbos observance. Save them now, and then they can observe many Shabbatot in the future. So therefore, I should save them. Now, this always leads to a classic question of, so what if it's somebody who isn't going to observe Shabbos? Right? What if the person you're going to save is not Shabbos observant? What if it's somebody who can't observe Shabbos? What if you're talking about somebody who is Jewish, but is not obligated in Shabbos because their level of function is not such that they would have halakhic obligations? Right? Somebody has severe dementia. So do you violate Shabbos to save somebody who isn't observing Shabbos anyway? The answer is yes. This is an across-the-board rule, and so we will violate Shabbos for them as well. That's the argument. And you'll see this argument becomes a very important halachic argument in many ways. That's all the Tanoim. Before we get to the Amoraim. All right, I got three hands. Chayla?
So if we're saying that if you like you're able to violate one Shabbos, then isn't that kind of saying that you're going to be mechal Shabbos? Like, isn't the whole like when you save someone, you're not like it's not you're not like necessarily being mechal Shabbos. Like, you're doing something good. But I feel like you're kind of saying that.
Right. Okay. So yes. Meaning, I think I mentioned in one of the first classes the idea from the Lubavitcher Rebbe that you're actually observing Shabbos by saving lives. But when we want to talk about the technical term for what happens when you drive on Shabbos or whatever it is, it's called Chilul Shabbos. Whether we view it, we still want you to do it, but that's just the term for it.
It's not an Avera.
It's not an Avera. Just the opposite is a mitzvah. Correct. Yes?
Well, what about if someone is able to observe Shabbos
The answer is yes. We're going to get back to, but the last item that I mentioned, is this really all lives? We're going to get back to that question. I saw a hand on this side of the room.
Yeah, I was just confused at the ending of that. You said that, you can save anyone, just so they can keep a Shabbos in the future, but what if they don't keep a Shabbos?
It doesn't matter. We save them anyway, even if we don't think they're going to keep a Shabbos in the future.
It
doesn't make a difference. Okay. Correct. Aliza? Yeah, I mean, that's what we're talking about. You mean,
no,
not just a medical situation. So we'll come back to that. Right. So it's a great question. We're going to come back to it. Yeah. Hopefully we'll get to it today. I'm not 100% sure, but it's one of the sources further down the page, number 6. Yeah.
Even though it's helping someone, even if they're not going to keep Shabbos, this isn't the source to be used to be the reason why we can save non-Jews.
We will have to get to it. All right, so that's the next to last argument, and it ends the Tanoim. But then you get an Amora. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda said, quoting Shmuel, just for your own knowledge base, Shmuel, I think I mentioned in a previous class, was also a doctor in addition to being one of the Amoraim. Rav Yehuda was a Talmud of both Rav and Shmuel. So sometimes you see him quote Rav, and sometimes you see him quote Shmuel. Yeah, Rav Yehuda was very cool. So Rav Yehuda says, quoting Shmuel, "I havoi hasam." If I had been there when the Tanoim were having this discussion, "Hava amina," I would have said, "I have a better source." All their sources you can argue against. I'll give you the answer, and this is an answer you've all hopefully heard at some point. Someone even mentioned it week one when I was talking about how we know the importance of saving lives overall. he says, the Torah says, these are the mitzvos that you shall perform, v'chai bahem, and you shall live by them, v'lo sheyamus bahem, and not to die by them. That's it. You're supposed to live by the mitzvos, you're not supposed to die by the mitzvos, although we do say that there are certain mitzvos that override saving lives, right? Idolatry, murder, sexual immorality. But he says, live by them, don't die by them. And Rava closes our stage of the discussion by saying, all of these could be countered. You could find arguments against the others, except Shmuel's. There's no argument against Shmuel's. That's the position that I accept. That's not the position, because all of them are saying the same thing, which is override Shabbos to save lives. But he says, that's the reason. That's how we know. Clear?
The last one?
Yeah. All right.
Does she refute them in the Gemara?
Yeah, so in I don't remember if it's him personally, but the Gemara brings refutations for all of them except for Shmuel. Except for, for V'chai Bahem. So, I mentioned to you, though, even though Rava says we knock out all of them but the last, even though Shmuel says, Rava says we knock out all but the last one, nonetheless, the argument of violate Shabbos in order to observe future Shabbatot remains important in Halacha. So take a look, for example, at source number 3. Gemara in Masechta Shabbos. Tinok ben Yomo, talking about a day-old infant. So the Gemara says, we desecrate Shabbos for a day-old infant. Now, I would have expected him to say, because it says, v'chai bahem, right? That would have been the argument. But it's not what he says. He says, why? Because the Torah says, desecrate one Shabbos for him so that he will observe many Shabbatot.
The Torah doesn't say that, the Gemara.
Correct. But the Torah being, what the Gemara being the explanation of what the Torah is saying when it says v'chai bahem. That's the idea. This is just an interpretation of what v'chai bahem means. You have to remember, when you see a drash, when you see someone in the Gemara say, this pasuk leads me to that, like we did with the word ach, right, before, very often it's an analysis of the text that's a very tight read of it, much tighter than people do when they normally read something. Meaning, when you read, unless you're analyzing poetry for your class on 18th century English literature, you tend to be very forgiving of the author. You open up a novel, or you open up the guidelines for school, or whatever it is, and you start reading, and you say, well, why did they use this adjective instead of that adjective? Why did they have this sentence? It's really just redundant with what they said before. You don't do that. You don't hold the author to account in that way. And what you get out of your read of the novel or whatever it is a pshat read. It's a simple, straightforward read of what the text is trying to tell you. However, in the event that you want to analyze and really understand what that author had in mind, you start to ask yourself those questions. You know? If you have somebody who you're close to who writes something and you really want to understand what they had in mind, you start asking yourself, why did they say it this way? Why didn't they say it that way? And that's what is done in reading the Torah. Why is the word ach there? You could have just said, es shabbos hayti shmoru, guard my Shabbatot. You didn't need the word ach. Or this whole line of v'shamru v'nei Yisrael es ha-shabbos, that the Jews should guard Shabbos, is redundant. It already said twice in the previous psukim, guard Shabbos. What did you add by saying v'shamru v'nei Yisrael es ha-shabbos? Or, these are my mitzvos that you shall perform, period. Who needed to say, and live by them? What did you add by saying, and live by them? So, Chazal are looking at it and saying, Hashem wants to tell me something. And that's where you get drash. As a basic principle, medrash is pshat when you're really listening to the words. However, it will often sacrifice things like context in order to explain the individual word. I'm getting a little far afield with that, but I think it's an important point to understand about how the way these drushos that we're reading work. Okay, so source number 3 is an example of the Torah saying, violate Shabbos to save lives, and using the argument that we said did not win. the argument of break one Shabbos in order to make sure someone will observe many Shabbatot. I'll give you an example outside of the realm of saving lives where this argument is used, because it's not just an argument about saving lives. Take a look at source number four, please. It's Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. You know that historically they would declare the new month when witnesses saw the new moon, right? You familiar with that? That was the way it was done. It wasn't done based on the calendar, like some printed calendar. You would, you know, see the new moon and you'd go testify in the Beis Din, and that's the way they would know to declare Rosh Chodesh. Yes, Ariane.
I don't know if it's a topic question, but if you break Shabbos, help someone, like, I don't know how much you break Shabbos, would you have to do tshuva for it?
No, you were supposed to do that. Yeah. Not only that, even if you broke Shabbos to save them, and then turned out it wasn't necessary, you would not need to do tshuva. There's a whole halachic discussion of this, which we will not get to this year, but it's a very interesting discussion. Rav Asher Weiss, in his Tshuvos Minchas Asher, asks the following question. You are a dispatcher for Hatzalah. There are a bunch of ambulances that answer a call, or people who answer a call for somebody on Shabbos. You know that the first one already reached the scene. Do you radio everybody and tell them, don't go? Because radioing on Shabbos is probably, depending on how it's done, whatever, can be done as a derabbanan. They're driving to get there, which is a deoraisa. So do you say, I should violate this derabbanan so that they don't all violate deoraisas? Or do I say, no, they are doing this in order to save lives? So a lot hinges on how I understand what they're doing when they're trying to save lives. Is there any liability for trying unsuccessfully? You know, that's where all of this, what all of this comes down to. So I believe, if I remember correctly, his answer was not to radio them, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'd have to go back and check the tshuva.
Sometimes they need two people, like, yeah.
That's also a concern. There's also a concern that the Gemara brings in general about medical care, that you can't assume that the other person is going to be able to cure it. Maybe you have special knowledge, relationship, whatever it is, and therefore you're the one who's really needed. So that's a concern as well. So in source number four, the Gemara talks about the witnesses breaking Shabbos because it's required in order to testify that they saw the new moon. And we get a story. Maaseh, once more than 40 pairs of witnesses came to testify that they saw the new moon. Clearly you don't need 40 witnesses to move on to the Beis Din. So Rabbi Akiva halted them in Lod. He told them, they came to him, they were in Lod, which is far from the Beis Din, and he said, you don't need to go any further. They already have enough witnesses. There's no point in going further. Rabbi Gamliel sent a message to him. He said, if you stop people from going, if you stop the masses from coming to testify, you know what's going to happen? In the future, they're not going to bother. Right? I saw the new moon. It's a big pain for me. I'm uprooting my Shabbos to go testify about the new moon? Somebody else saw it for sure, right? You know psychology.
This is happening on Shabbos.
On Shabbos, correct.
Is it breaking?
Yeah, what's breaking with the...
So let's say they're traveling outside of any Erev area, outside of the Tchum is another possibility. They may need to carry weapons because they're concerned about wild animals or bandits on the road. There are a range of possible violations involved. If you learn Mishnayos Maseches Rosh Hashanah, during Rosh Hashanah, you'll see this discussion there. So Rabbi Akiva says that you don't have them go on, and Rabbi Gamliel says, no, we need to make sure that they're going to do this in the future. And the Chasam Sofer, explaining it in source number 5, says, what does that mean? He says, Rabbi Gamliel got the idea from the pasuk of Vishamru v'nei yisrael ha-shabbos la'asos es ha-shabbos Amra Torah chalol shabbos achas k'di sheyishmor shabbosos harbei. The Torah says, desecrate one Shabbos in order to observe many Shabbatot. Similarly here, violate Shabbos in order to make sure that in the future, your Yom Tov is all going to work out. Your Shabbos is all going to be, Shabbos will be fine, but your Yom Tovim will be coordinated properly. So he's even allowing it for that and making that argument of Halel Shabbos Achas. This comes up in Halacha. So I did get to the case that somebody asked about. I don't remember, it was somewhere in here. It might have been Tova or Ella or Ruthie. Somebody in that section asked the question about, for kiva purposes. Who asked it? It was you, the one person in the row I didn't mention. All right, it was Lisa's question. Take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avraham, classic commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, deals with a case in which someone's daughter is kidnapped on Shabbos, or it might not be a kidnapping, it's not so clear, but she's leaving in order to observe a non-Jewish life altogether. Do you go after on Shabbos, violating Shabbos, in order to get her back? So take a look at Rabbi Avram Gambiner's comment. He says, "Afilu lamanda amar dahavi de oraisa shari." Even within the view that going after her in the way that you would have to, which I'm not discussing right now, is biblically prohibited. Let's say leaving the tchum. Even if you'll tell me that leaving the tchum is biblically prohibited, nonetheless, you still may do it. Why? Since to prevent her from assimilating and living her entire life in desecration of Shabbos, this is a small violation. Better to desecrate one Shabbos that she'll observe many Shabbatot. He's quoting Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef. On the other hand, he says, if all they want is that she perform an Avera just once, then I would say, so don't violate Shabbos for her, because it's one Avera versus one Avera, then don't. But otherwise, you do. I mean, who's going to really hold themselves back if their daughter has actually been taken? Like, that's a good question. Nonetheless, that's the psak of the Magen Avraham, which again I bring for you just so you understand this argument of Halel Shabbos Achas is brought halachically. Another example of it, which I did not bring in this on the sheet, the Chasam Sofer talks about putting somebody into some kind of facility, some kind of institution, where they don't have kosher food available. But with the hope that it's going to help them to recuperate from their illness to the point where they're able to rejoin the community and observe mitzvos and so on. And again, brings in this same idea. Is everyone following? We're good? Yeah.
Naomi. Sorry, I don't understand why, even if it's just one sin, that you go after.
Because the argument is it's not to observe many Shabbatot. Now it's just my Avera of leaving versus her Avera. What? Sorry? No, but it's not about saving her life at all. Her life's not in danger.
You don't know that.
No, but this is a case where you do. That's his case. That's why I'm saying that I'm not 100% clear that the case he's talking about is actually a kidnapping. When you look at the sources that he's drawing on for this case, it's not so clear that this is even against her will. This may be a case where his daughter has eloped with some non-Jewish guy, you know, and that's what he's talking about. Or where it's a one-time thing that's going on. It's a more complicated case than I'm giving it credit for, because I'm just bringing it as an example as opposed to something that's core to what we're talking about. But I'll give you an example of this, which is completely outside of Hilchos Shabbos, just to show you the way this argument gets used. It's a tshuva, it's a response from Rav Asher Weiss, who I just mentioned before. For those who don't know of him, he is a major halachic authority living in Israel today, and rules on major contemporary issues in ways that are very compelling. So he's dealing here with a case of somebody who's dealing with OCD. And one of the manifestations very often for people with OCD outside of a religious context is being uncertain that they said what they meant to say, that their words are coming out properly. In a religious context, it comes up when someone is making brachos and they're worried, did I say the bracha properly? Did I say shema properly? Did I daven properly? And unfortunately, it's a horrible position to be in, where they'll end up saying the same thing over and over again, repeating, because they don't know whether they said it properly. It's torture. So Rav Asher Weiss was asked the question of whether, as part of this person's process of treatment, they could be told, you say it once and that's it. Don't go back. Even if it was wrong, don't go back. You say the bracha once, and then you eat whatever, you know, whatever it is. And his answer is yes, that's what you do. And he brings our argument as part of the discussion. If you take a look in source number 7, he says doctors who are expert in this field of treating OCD believe that the way to treat it is that he never repeat any statement or prayer. When it is clear as the sun to him that he has not said the name properly, Hashem's name, and he has not fulfilled his duty in his bracha, may he eat. The patient says, I know I didn't say it right. What do you tell the patient? And his answer is, even if we would say that one may not violate a prohibition for medical purposes, let's say you said that that just doesn't justify eating without a bracha. Let's pretend you said that. Our case is different. For if he would not be healed and freed from his crisis, he would violate these mitzvos forever. Even if you're going to tell me that it's bad that he's not saying the bracha properly, and he's not justified now in eating, so what solution are you proposing? If he doesn't get treated, he's going to live his whole life not saying brachas properly. So therefore, he says, in any such case, we say, better to desecrate one Shabbos and not desecrate many Shabbatot. It appears in our case, too, this precious person may cancel blessings and Shema in order to be healed so that he will be able to fulfill these mitzvos properly. He says, tell him, don't repeat it, and that will be part of the therapeutic process, hopefully, to lead to a refuah. Clear? Okay. So what we've said at this stage is everybody is in agreement. We violate Shabbos to save lives. There is a dispute as to your textual source. We have two, so to speak, winning sources in the Gemara, although the one that the Gemara identifies as the winning one is v'chai b'hem, live by them. And we also have the argument of violate one Shabbos in order to observe many. Yes, Eliza? You can ask, and I can choose not to answer.
So, even if it wasn't for this treatment, if you said a bracha and you weren't sure if you said it properly, you would repeat it again.
Right. So there's a basic principle of suffik brachos lahakel.
Right.
If I'm not sure regarding a bracha, for almost all brachos, we are lenient, because it's a derabanan usually. There are a couple of exceptions to that rule, but that's sort of the basic approach to brachos. But we're talking about somebody who says, no, I know I said it wrong. He's not in doubt. He says, I know I didn't say it right. Okay. So this idea of violating Shabbos in order to save lives goes beyond dramatic, explicitly life-saving actions. It's not only about those. It includes a question that I know a few of you have asked about already, and I said to you, just wait, we're going to get to it. So lo and behold, we got to it. The question of a prophylactic action to prevent a situation from becoming pikuach nefesh. Example, someone has a wound, and it's starting to get infected. If you leave it, if you don't put ointment on it, there's a real risk that infection can be life-threatening, like a tetanus type of a situation, let's say. So, and again, I'm not a doctor. Please don't take that as medical advice. But if you take a look at sources number 8 and 9, you'll see what I'm talking about. The Shulchan Aruch talks about what's called a makah she'ena shel chalal, which requires that I first explain a makah shel chalal. A chalal... the word halal can mean different things. What does the word halal mean? Anybody know? To desecrate the chalal, right?
A kohen
who has married a divorcee, let's say, so his children will be a halal, will be halalim. But something outside of the realm of desecration. Okay. Well, that's part of the desecration. It means to make something mundane. Chol. Oh, okay. Don't know. Usually, lechalel is from making something chol or chulin. You're making it mundane. But there's a whole other explanation for the word chalal. Yes. So chalal can also mean a void. Something that is hollow. Outer space is usually called chalal in modern Hebrew. So here, it's talking about a dead body. Not a dead body, excuse me, that's not true. Chalal can mean dead body, but it means the inside of the body. That's what it means, sorry. So makah shel chalal means an injury that's inside the body, it's internal, and that has certain rules within halacha. Here it's talking about makah shel eina shel chalal. It's not internal, and therefore an expert can look at it and say, oh, I know what to do, because I can see it and analyze it. The problem with an internal wound is you don't necessarily know what you're looking at because it's inside. you know, modern times we have equipment that in the 16th century nobody had. We can do x-rays, MRIs, all sorts of scans. They didn't have that option. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, Maka she'ena shel chalal, for a non-internal wound, we ask an expert and we ask the patient. Meaning, you ask the doctor, is this person's life in danger? And we ask the patient, do you feel that you are in danger? The whole thing of consulting a patient is its own discussion. But that's what we do. Hang on, Ariana. Ve'ein mechalin olav Shabbos. We would not violate Shabbos for the patient. Ad sheyomar echad mehem shu tzarach lechilul, unless one of them says that it's necessary to do so. Or she'asa etzel echad mehem sakanas nefashos. Or if one of them views it as a danger to life. The Ariana, you were going to say?
What does it mean that, like, they ask them how they're doing? Like, they obviously came to, like, let's say on Shabbos, they went to the hospital because, like, there's, like, a big infection on their leg. If they obviously went to the hospital, so why are they asking them, oh, like, how do you...
Well, the question is how dire they think it is, but you're also looking at it through 21st century lenses, meaning... The classic case that this is drawing on is a Yom Kippur case of somebody who faints, let's say, or they seem very, very weak, and the question is, should we feed them or not? And the Gemara's assumption is that, number one, doctors are aware of what to do, but number two, people are cognizant of their own physical condition such that they are able, about certain illnesses and dangers, to say, I'm in danger, I need this now. So that we say, if the doctor says that the patient doesn't need to eat on Yom Kippur, but the patient says, I need it and I'm in danger, we actually feed the patient. That's what the Gemara mentions. So this is a Shabbos version of that discussion. Rina. So that's the Shulchan Aruch. I didn't get to my point yet. That's just the Shulchan Aruch that the Mishnah Brura, number 9, is commenting on. The Mishnah Brura says that when it says, at the end of the line, it says, we would only violate Shabbos if one of them says it's necessary or one of them views it as a danger to life. That line was odd in the Shulchan Aruch, the end of the line, right? Wasn't it redundant? If one of them says it's necessary, then one of them views it as a danger to life. What's the difference between the two? What? Sorry?
Same thing.
It's the same thing, correct. You read it, like, well, what did he add? Sorry?
Unless it's saying that maybe it's necessary, but, like, it's really not, like, immediately.
But it didn't say that. But it's hard to see that in the Shulchan Aruch language. So the Mishnah Brura says, I'll tell you why. There's a word missing. The word is suffek, doubt, possibility. It should say that it becomes, for them, a possible danger to life. That's the way to read it. Meaning, as I wrote in number 9, even if they say that maybe the illness will worsen and he will be endangered, it is permitted. And that's why the Ramah concluded C-section 618, which is in the laws of Yom Kippur, for there this point is made regarding eating on Yom Kippur, the rule is the same here. Meaning, even if there is a possibility that will turn into a life-threatening situation, we violate Shabbos for them. Are we clear? Got it? We're good over here? This side of the room's gotten very quiet. Yes, Ella.
What's the difference between this and just the general Safek Pikuach Nefesh?
So this is Safek Pikuach Nefesh. That's exactly right. So number one, Pikuach Nefesh includes prophylactic actions that prevent a situation from possibly becoming pikuach nefesh in the future. It also includes doing what you do for such a patient normally during the week. Take a look at number 10. I mentioned this, you know, a while back, but you'll see it here in the Shulchan Aruch. He says, this is probably, I think, where we'll end up holding. We'll see. Let's see what he says. He says, an internal wound, maka shel chalal, it's inside, need not be evaluated, even without experts. And with the patient saying nothing, we do for him all that we would normally do during the week. So number one, he's talking about where you don't have the ability to analyze and diagnose. it's inside and you have no way to know what's going on. But number two, he says you do everything we would normally do if the patient came in on a Tuesday. So not just, you know, the minimum I need to save lives, but whatever is normal treatment. And then he goes on to say, if you know and recognize that it can wait, so fine. Then don't violate Shabbos. If you know that it can wait, so it can wait. Where you don't know, you assume danger and you treat the way that you would treat normally. So we don't start saying, well, don't hook up that IV. Maybe we don't need that IV, so, you know, or you know, don't take their blood pressure. Like, that's what you do for this patient. You take their blood pressure, whether it's Tuesday or Shabbos. That's the rule. Tamima. Huh, I got it right. Sorry. Does that include x-rays?
Yeah.
Potentially, yes.
Because it says that, like, it should be evaluated.
No, what he's talking about there is that you don't need to evaluate in order to know whether to violate Shabbos or not, because I don't have the capacity to do it. Once I have capacity to do an evaluation, then we do, but always erring on the side of caution. Ruthie and then Rina.
This is only applying for an internal wound?
This is, yeah, well, no, the rule of doing whatever's normal is for all. It's the point he's making in the first part of it is that where you can't analyze, you err on the side of caution, where you don't have access because it's internal. Rena.
I'm connected to the question before. Once you have analyzed because you're erring on the side of caution, a part of doing that is they analyze it. Once you find out it could wait, then you stop.
Yes. Correct.
I don't really understand that. Like, you're
yeah.
Like you do normally during the week in all cases.
It you would do that correct. Whether it's an internal wound or not an internal wound doesn't change anything.
I thought it does because then you don't know, like you can't evaluate.
Right, but in a case of a non-internal that you've evaluated and determined needs life-saving treatment, mm-hmm. or in a case where I don't know that it's bikuach nefesh because I don't have the ability to analyze it, safe bikuach nefesh, I'm going to treat like bikuach nefesh, and therefore I'm going to do whatever is normally done. I'm going to do whatever is normally done for either of these. Correct. Correct. Elisa. Yeah. The expert and the patient.
Yeah.
No, because, again, there's an assumption that people have an awareness of their own health situation, and therefore they may tell you, I need this, and it's life and death, even if the doctor doesn't perceive it. So what we're going to end up doing is coming back to this point, because there's one more thing that you really need to see in this Mishnah Berurah, but I'll say it outside for now, which is the Mishnah Berurah is going to comment that in the event that there's no substantive concern, then you don't do it. If there's no substantive concern, then I'm not going to tell you violate Shabbos this person because it's routinely done. So you would say in the hospital, normally, let's pretend this isn't necessarily true, every 2 hours they come in and take the patient's temperature. The patient's illness has nothing to do with a fever. They're not in need of the temperature being taken, so don't take their temperature just because we do it on Tuesdays. But whatever is routine for this kind of a patient, not just because it's protocol in the hospital, but because this is the way you care for them, you would do. That's what the Mishnah Berurah is going to tell us in number 11. Okay, we have a lot more to see about this. I'm going to let you know, God willing, whether we're doing an actual class or whether we're doing an article. I'm not sure, so I'll be in touch. But I wish everybody ksiva chasima tova and a shana tova.